You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Three more U.S. soldiers were wounded in Iraq today in separate attacks near the cities of Fallujah and Mosul. Witnesses say one soldier was injured when a mine exploded as an American military convoy passed nearby. Another two were wounded in separate attacks with explosive devices and small arms. Well, today on Peace Watch, we're going to continue our examination of the human cost of war, not just in Iraq, but around the world. All this week, we're playing excerpts of a documentary entitled Beyond War, which takes a look at the effects of war on families, children, and societies, both domestically and abroad.
It turned out in the Gulf War that there were very large numbers of civilian casualties. The word accident is used again and again by the military when it is pointed out that their bombs killed civilians. And some of them are accidents in the sense that they didn't intend to kill civilians, but at the same time, not really accidents in the sense that when you start bombing, the killing of civilians is inevitable. So it's neither deliberate nor an accident, but there's something in between deliberate and accident, and the word is inevitable.
The shocking rise of civilian casualties of modern warfare. You're listening to Beyond War, a documentary project from Humankind. I'm David Freudberg. Anyone who has watched a child grow and who has pondered the awesome wonder and value of human life can't help but mourn the snuffing out of life that is always the consequence of warfare's brutality and terror. The death of soldiers who knowingly venture into battle is memorialized by their countrymen the world over. But in modern warfare, increasingly, it is innocent civilians who have not chosen to make war, many too young even to understand it, whose lives are shattered in the ferocity of organized violence. Chris Hedges has covered numerous wars for the New York Times.
I think everyone who spends a long time in war is emotionally damaged by war. And I don't think we understand, most of us understand, how devastating that damage is to a society. We look at the cost of war in terms of its physical cost, in terms of the destruction of villages, towns, roads, water purification plants. But perhaps more devastating is the psychological destruction of an entire generation. You can see this in Bosnia, where there's a listlessness in Sarajevo, an inability to believe anymore in anything. People are lost. People feel betrayed. War, as the ancient Greeks and Romans knew, was a god. It always calls for human sacrifice.
At a Veterans Day observance in Cambridge, Massachusetts, a little girl in the crowd cowers at the frightening rifle blasts. In the traditional rules of war and also in international law, soldiers are classified differently from civilians. Those in military service are considered willing participants in war and thus more legitimate military targets, although historically many have been conscripted against their will. But whether in uniform or not, human beings who experience the destructive powers of war are often scarred by what they have witnessed and endured. For some, the psychological disturbance is long-lasting. Yael Danieli, a counselor to war survivors in New York City, has observed some of the characteristics of people damaged by military violence.
Difficulty falling or staying asleep, irritability or outbursts of anger, which of course also has implications interpersonally. Difficulty concentrating has strong implications for work life. Hypervigilance, you're always on guard and you always look out for trouble. And exaggerated startle response. Any little noise, you jump.
So you're kind of living on pins and needles.
Precisely. Well, you're living in the war zone, except you're at home.
A tendency to relive the terrible scenes of war has tormented Daryl Urchell, a Vietnam veteran and a spinal cord patient at the Heinz VA hospital outside Chicago.
My anger gets all very easily upset for no cause. And then constant reminders, just not a day probably goes by and I'll recur, something that transpired when I was over Vietnam, so it's a constant haunting, which I wish would go away, but it doesn't.
What form does it take? Is it nightmares?
Well, nightmares, even during the day sometimes. Some subtle noise, something like that, make you jump. So anything, a lot of things, smells, noise. So I would avoid listening to certain things, like a lot of times the news that might relate, especially like now with the people think, after so long, you sure forget, but it's kind of hard. One of those things you just can't, it's like embedded. And just like a record just keeps playing over and over and over in your head. You wish it would just stop. You kind of go on with your life. Ever since I've been home, really can't make any close friends since I've been out, or any like relationships. Don't want to get close to people.
What do you think is the fear about getting close to people?
Well, because if every time you got close to somebody, you somebody died, after a while, you just do it as a reaction, so you wouldn't have those feelings again.
So for you in the service, you got close to people who then died?
Correct, yeah. Quite a few people like that, but even to this day, I can remember, Terry Foreman, already had 52 days left in the country, wife, kids, and everything else, never made it back home. So that still, bothers me, all the time. I don't know, is war the answer? It's going on for 1,000 years. Doesn't seem like it's really resolved anything.
The last war of the old type was the First World War, the so-called Great War.
Historian Sven Lindqvist at his home in Stockholm, Sweden.
Which stalemated along the French-German frontier. And you could live rather peacefully as a civilian behind those lines on both sides. Not very much happened, say. The enemy bombing killed in Britain during the whole of the First World War 1,400 people, which was a mere fraction of the soldiers' lives that one day could cost at the front. So civilian losses were then rather small. Today, you reckon that civilian losses are, in several wars, have been something like 80 or even 90%, which is the situation turned around. The dangerous thing in today's wars is not to be the soldier, but to be the civilian.
Completely innocent.
Well, what harm has a small child done? A small child can maybe grow up into an enemy in some decades' time, but that's hardly a reason to kill them.
Targeting innocent civilians for murder is always and everywhere wrong.
June 2002, U.S. President George W. Bush addressing graduates at West Point Military Academy.
There can be no neutrality between justice and cruelty. Between the innocent and the guilty. We are in a conflict between good and evil, and America will call evil by its name.
The official policy of governments the world over is to protect civilians from military hostilities in accordance with international law. But the stark reality of war today is that the vast majority of casualties are not soldiers wearing any government's uniform.
Civilians are the victims of choice in modern warfare. The military actually is much more likely to protect its own. It's actually safer to be a serviceman in modern conflicts than it is to be a housewife.
University of London historian Joanna Burke is author of An Intimate History of Killing.
The military have a zero tolerance for our side being killed, okay? But they don't have a zero tolerance for civilians being killed. Within the military, there is this culture of protection. Civilians are, of course, sitting ducks. They are easy, much easier targets. Also, they are regarded by the enemy as being much more effective in breaking down, destroying the morale within the military.
The rationale is to destroy civilian life, what is called the vital centers of the enemy. That is mothers and children and old people and all that are not soldiers in armor or soldiers dug down in bunkers and having been made difficult to get at with bombs.
In his fascinating book, A History of Bombing, Sven Lindqvist chronicles the terrible 20th century invention of aerial bombardment. Immediately upon development of the airplane, war planners recognized the military potential of flying over a target and releasing high-powered explosives. One concept was called area bombing, whose objective was to destroy an entire area, such as a populated city, using this new weapon.
The theory of this thing was explained very early. In 1912, a British mathematician called Lanchester explained that if you could strike out the firefighting machinery of a city, then you could burn it down to the ground. The thing was to concentrate and start as many fires as possible in a given area. And then the effect of each fire would be multiplied because it would be impossible to put them out. And this was, with great success, used, for instance, in Iraq in the 20s. When the British used bombs instead of infantry battalions to keep Iraq occupied. Whenever there was an uprising in some part of the country, they went there with bombers and burned the villages, which was much more effective and saved many of their own soldiers' lives as compared with what a punitive expedition of the ordinary kind would have cost.
British Tornado jets flying a sortie during the Gulf War. With today's military technology, the pilot can hover in relative safety high above the target location. But modern weaponry is frequently a blunt instrument of destruction with unreliable accuracy. The slight finger movement by a pilot pressing a button can rain down indiscriminate devastation on those below, including the innocent.
Well, it's a kind of interesting moral calculation that's being made.
Boston University historian Howard Zinn.
And that is, if 100 people die on the ground, it's to save one person up in this airplane who's dropping the bomb. Now, this implies that the lives of these people are worth far less than the life of the person dropping a bomb. And then you have to add to that really unacceptable moral calculation. The fact that the person dropping the bomb is an aggressor. He is on the attack. The people down there are helpless. And he is not dropping a bomb on people who are shooting at him. Maybe there are 3 people down there shooting at him and 100 people who are not shooting at him, but all of whom will die. So the moral calculation there, you know, I think, cannot be accepted by anybody who claims to value human life equally, whether it's somebody on the other side of a border or somebody on this side of a border.
During the Gulf War of 1991, high technology made possible the tiny number of casualties suffered by Americans and also produced massive death and destruction among soldiers and civilians on the ground in Iraq, where the bombs fell. New York Times reporter Chris Hedges covered the war and for a time was held captive by Iraqi forces.
There was no clean water, no electricity. The entire infrastructure was wiped out. I remember I was with my Iraqi captors. I was with a light armor battalion that was trying to make its way north to Baghdad. All the communications had been cut, and we were heavily ambushed about 60 miles north of Basra. And 16 hours of fighting, had to turn back. But I remember at one point standing with my Iraqi guards in the rain, and we had to get our water out of mud puddles, the color of coffee. And it had already turned my own guts inside out. And as we were scooping the water up, a mother came with 2 tiny children and began drinking the water. And I knew what that water had done to me. And I knew potentially what drinking that dirty water would do to her tiny children. And I remember in the rain reciting, it was almost an unintelligible blessing, the poem by W.H. Auden, Epitaph on a Tyrant. Perfection of a kind was what he was after, and the poetry he invented was easy to understand. He knew human folly like the back of his hand, and was greatly interested in armies and fleets. When he laughed, respectable senators burst with laughter, and when he cried, the little children died in the streets.
We have spent more than $1 billion a month, over $30 million a day, and we must be prepared for future operations. Afghanistan proved that expensive precision weapons defeat the enemy and spare innocent lives, and we need more of them.
On the face of it, the development of smart weapons seems good because less and less innocent civilians are being killed.
A new generation of costly arms technology, guided by computer accuracy, is often cited as a practical means of reducing unintended civilian deaths and injuries in war. Richard Bingley in London at the Campaign Against Arms Trade.
But the psychological impact of the development of smart weapons is that all of a sudden it becomes easier to intervene militarily in various areas, and therefore you might be more likely to intervene militarily in more areas. And therefore, although less innocent civilians are killed at any given situation, there might be more situations where fewer innocent civilians are being killed. And the total of that is that you have a huge amount of innocent civilians being killed. You know, that towards the end of the 21st century, we are just dropping every day in different regions of the world smart weapons because we're trying to take out a terrorist threat.
The term smart weapons suggests some kind of godlike precision in the use of these armaments. Is that quite accurate?
Well, they're quite accurate. If you program them into a set of coordinates, then they will hit the coordinates, usually. But if your intelligence is so bad that at that particular time where the coordinates are, there are innocent civilians, then the innocent civilians will get caught. You know, for instance, there was a wedding in northern Afghanistan and 48 people were killed at the wedding. The smart missile, as I understand it, was entirely accurate. It hit the site that it was predestined for, hit the coordinates completely correct. But the intelligence is so bad that the wrong people were at the right place at the right time. And that's the risk that we might be facing in the future. And you see that all the time in Israel, don't you? You see, rightly or wrongly, the taking out of a terrorist threat in Israel. But they're never alone. They're always surrounded by people. Or I remember a Hellfire missile hitting a group of 16 people in Gaza, and it took out the military leader of Hamas. But it also killed 9 children. So perhaps, you know, when we think about the legacy of smart weapons, yes, on the one hand, it can be more accurate. It can be more useful as a military tool. But on the other hand, it makes us more ready to use military action, probably.
My budget includes the largest increase in defense spending in 2 decades. Because while the price of freedom and security is high, it is never too high. Whatever it costs to defend our country, we will pay.
The huge rise in military spending in the wake of the September 11, 2001 attacks has enlarged the marketplace for the weapons makers who develop armaments and supply them to armies. And although some weapons are top secret, a surprising number are publicly advertised and marketed. At a recent convention of the Association of the United States Army, hundreds of weapons manufacturers crammed into the corridors and exhibit halls of hotels in downtown Washington, D.C. At one booth, people lined up to take target practice with a new model rifle. At a nearby table, the sign boasted 20 million projectiles shipped. Products ranged from thick bullets half a foot long to tanks, to a futuristic-looking infantry rifle that reminded me of a bat with outspread wings. The literature claimed it significantly increases lethality. The slogan of one firm was "No Place to Hide." All manner of Army personnel in uniform mingled with salesmen in a spirited atmosphere. I was accompanied by an Army Brigadier General, John Hutton, who is also a military surgeon. I wanted to understand what some of these weapons might do to the human body.
They've had some new developments recently that create huge overpressures, things of that sort.
Overpressure means?
Well, it means creating pressures that are much greater than atmospheric pressure. These were initially designed probably to be detonated in caves or in inside areas. If you were near an area in Vietnam, for instance, where the B-52s had done this carpet bombing, and some of the people that just couldn't get out of the way of it would come in with these overpressure injuries.
What would be the nature of the injury?
Mainly pulmonary. The eardrums would go first. And if you see somebody walking around with sort of a stunned expression on their face, eyes widely dilated, having perhaps some foam, a pinkish foam, coming out of their lungs into their mouth, that would be a sign that there'd been not only damage to the eardrums, but there'd be multiple pulmonary contusions. There's a handheld rocket, and let's go over and look at that.
We walked over to a booth manned by Werner Reinl, a salesman for the Diehl Company, a weapons manufacturer headquartered in Nuremberg, Germany.
This is a rocket that you'd position on your shoulder.
You can launch from your shoulder, yes.
Then it's a bunker buster, you know. You know what a bunker buster is? Normally, it is an anti-tank ammunition, you know, if you kill the tanks. And we have modified the warhead because we have a special deal knowledge on warhead and ammunition. And this warhead is a two-stage warhead. It goes through the wall. and inside it explodes, you know, with fragments, you know. And that's why we call it bunker buster. And then you can do sand or concrete or wooden wall, and you can attack people behind this wall, you know.
And you get this concussive effect. And offensive weapons are usually those that make concussion and give you the shock effect. And then, of course, by the bunker buster, if you can get it through the bunker wall, everything inside is neutralized, at least temporarily, and you rush in and...
Neutralized means they're in shock, or...
Neutralized means whatever's in there is not effective. They're neutral.
They're dead?
They're neutral. Can be, surely.
How many metal fragments would be released in one of these blasts? Are we talking hundreds?
No, hundreds.
And all of them could pierce the body?
Yes. Depending on the velocity, yes, sure. If you were in a house and that went off, absolutely, they'd not. There's two definitions. One is to penetrate, and the other is to perforate. And a lot of them would probably perforate, meaning go totally through the extremity or through the chest.
And you need an effective weapon system, you know, because if you have not an effective weapon system, then you are killed if you approach the house. And therefore, you know, that it's maybe not a human system, you know, but it's against terrorists and what we have to face, you know.
You're saying it's not necessarily a human system?
I think no war is human, you know.
The surreal atmosphere of all these weapons of destruction became almost overwhelming. The amazing array of devices that had been thought up and manufactured for the purpose of killing and maiming and powerfully exploding, all here on display in a kind of vast department store where salesmen glad-hand buyers trying to close the deal.
May I have one of these brochures,
sir?
Yes.
How many you will order?
How many will I order? What would one of those rocket launchers go for?
No. What is the roundabout the price? It depends, you know, it depends on the quantity. It depends on a lot of things.
Let's say I bought 100.
100 is... we do not... normally we have 1,000, you know.
Let's say I bought 10,000 of them.
10,000, I don't know. What is the roundabout?
$5,000 at a quantity of 10,000.
Yeah.
For your $4.99.
Listening to Beyond War, a documentary project from Humankind. I'm David Freudberg. Studio recording by Steve Colby. Editorial assistance from Francis McGovern and Kathy Graham. Music performed by Brad Hatfield. Research assistance by Erzalee Coquillon. Special thanks to Benjamin Ferenz, Bernard Laun, and Steve Cedar. Our program is presented by Human Media in association with The Network Incorporated. Program development and support provided by Chart Media.
Major funding for this program is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the Colomb Foundation, the Compton Foundation, and from this station and the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
Beyond War is produced by David Freudberg and distributed by PRI, Public Radio International. If you'd like to purchase a cassette copy of Beyond War by phone, please call toll-free 1-800-5-LISTEN. Tune in tomorrow on Peace Watch and every day this week for more of this series. Pacifica's Peace Watch is produced in Washington, D.C. Our producer is Scott Gurian, our editor is Lona Elias, and our engineer is T from the Pattersons, taking the train to Tibet. We had production assistance from Jim Bennett and Adil Hamid of KPFA, Matt Bradley and Sam Husseini. Thanks to Pete Karakas, RadioForAll.net, and Alex Mitchell at WebActive.com for web help. It's your financial support that makes Peace Watch possible. So we urge you to make a generous donation through our secure online website at pacifica.org, or you can send your donations to Pacifica Radio, 2390 Champlain Street, Northwest, Washington, D.C., 20009. We'd love to hear your thoughts on the show. You can send your feedback to us at peacewatch@pacifica.org. You can also visit webactive.com to listen to archives of past Peace Watch programs. To get a copy of this show, call the Pacifica Radio Archives at 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. I'm Verna Avery Brown, the executive producer. Thank you for listening.